Slowly I rose into the air, like thistledown bobbing in a vagrant breeze. The moon had risen now, flooding the valley and mountain peaks with pure and silvery light. I looked in horror at ancient lamaseries, bombed and untenanted, with all the debris of man's earthly possessions strewn about uncared for. The unburied dead lay in grotesque heaps, preserved by the eternal cold. Some clutched prayer wheels, some were stripped of clothing and ripped into tattered shreds of bloody flesh by bomb blast and metal splinters. I saw a sacred figure, intact, gazing down as if in compassion at the murderous folly of mankind. Upon the craggy slopes, where the hermitages clung to the sides of the mountains in loving embrace, I saw hermitage after hermitage which had been despoiled by the invaders. The hermits, immured for years in solitary darkness in search of spiritual advancement, had been blinded on the instant when sunlight had entered their cells. Almost without exception, the hermit was stretched dead beside his ruined home, with his lifelong friend and servant stretched dead beside him. I could look no more. Carnage? Senseless murder of the innocent, defenseless monks? What was the use? I turned away and called upon those who guided me to remove me from this graveyard. My task in life, I had known from the start, was in connection with the human aura, that radiation which entirely surrounds the human body, and by its fluctuating color shows the adept if a person is honorable or otherwise. The sick person could have his or her illness seen by the colors of the aura. Everyone must have noticed the haze around a street light on a misty night. Some may even have noticed the well-known corona discharge from high-tension cables at certain times. The human aura is somewhat similar. It shows the life force within. Artists of old painted a halo, or nimbus round the head of saints. Why? Because they could see the aura of those people. Since the publication of my first two books, people have written to me from all over the world, and some of those people can also see the aura. Years ago, a Dr. Kilner, researching at a London hospital, found that he could, under certain circumstances, see the aura. He wrote a book about it. Medical science was not ready for such a discovery, and all that he had discovered was hushed up. I too, in my way, am doing research, and I visualize an instrument which will enable any medical man or scientist to see the aura of another and cure incurable illnesses by ultrasonic vibrations. Money. Money, that is the problem. Research always was expensive. And now, I mused, they want me to take on another task. About a change of bodies. Outside my window there was a shuddering crash which literally shook the house. Oh, I thought, the railroad men are shunting again. There will be no more quiet for a long time. On the river a Great Lakes freight steamer hooted mournfully, like a cow mooing for her calf, and from the distance came the echoing response of another ship. My brother. The voice came to me again, and hastily I gave my attention to the crystal. The old men were still sitting in a circle with the aged patriarch in the center. Now they were looking tired, exhausted would perhaps describe their condition more accurately, for they had transmitted much power in order to make this impromptu, unprepared trip possible. My brother, you have seen clearly the condition of our country. You have seen the hard hand of the oppressor. Your task, your two tasks are clear before you and you can succeed at both, to the glory of our order. The tired old man was looking anxious. He knew, as I knew, that I could with honor refuse this task. I had been greatly misunderstood through the lying tales spread by an ill-disposed group. Yet I was very highly clairvoyant, very highly telepathic. Astral traveling to me was easier than walking. Right? Well, yes, people could read what I wrote, and if they could not all believe, then those who were sufficiently evolved would believe and know the truth. My brother, said the old man, softly, even though the unevolved, the unenlightened, pretend to believe that you write fiction, enough of the truth will get to their subconscious and, who knows, the small seed of truth may blossom in this or in their next life. As the Lord Buddha himself had said in the parable of the three chariots, the end justifies the means. The parable of the three chariots. What vivid memories that brought back to me. How clearly I remember my beloved guide and friend, the Lama Minyadon Up, instructing me at the Chakporai. An old medical monk had been easing the fears of a very sick woman with some harmless white lie. I, young and inexperienced, had, with smug complacency, been expressing shocked surprise that a monk should tell an untruth even in such an emergency. My guide would come along to me, saying, "Let us go to my room, Lobsang. We can with profit turn to the scriptures." He smiled at me with his warm, benevolent aura of contentment as he turned and walked beside me to his room far up, overlooking the Potala. "Tea and Indian cakes, yes, we must have refreshment, Lobsang, for with refreshment you can also digest information." The monk servant, who had seen us enter, appeared unbidden with the delicacies which I liked and which I could only obtain through the good offices of my guide. For a time we sat and talked idly, or rather I talked as I ate. Then, as I finished, the illustrious Lama said, "There are exceptions to every rule, Lobsang, and every coin or token has two sides." The Buddha talked at length to his friends and disciples, and much that he said was written down and preserved. There is a tale very applicable to the present. I will tell it to you. He resettled himself, cleared his throat, and continued, "This is the tale of the three chariots, called so because chariots were greatly in demand among the boys of those days, just as stilts and Indian sweet cakes are now." The Buddha was talking to one of his followers named Sariputra. They were sitting in the shade of one of the large Indian trees discussing truth and untruth, and how the merits of the former are sometimes outweighed by the kindness of the latter. The Buddha said, "Now, Sariputra, let us take the case of a very rich man, a man so rich that he could afford to gratify every whim of his family. He is an old man with a large house and with many sons. Since the birth of those sons he has done everything to protect them from danger. They know not danger and they have not experienced pain. The man left his estate and his house and went to a neighboring village on a matter of business. As he returned he saw smoke rolling up into the sky. He hurried faster and as he approached his home he found that it was on fire. All the four walls were on fire, and the roof was burning. Inside the house his sons were still playing, for they did not understand the danger. They could have got out but they did not know the meaning of pain because they had been so shielded. They did not understand the danger of fire because the only fire they had seen had been in the kitchens. The man was greatly worried for how could he alone get into the house and save his sons? Had he entered, he could perhaps have carried out one only, the others would have played and thought it all a game. Some of them were very young, they might have rambled and walked into the flames they had not learned to fear. The father went to the door and called to them, saying, "Boys, boys, come out. Come here immediately." But the boys did not want to obey their father. They wanted to play. They wanted to huddle in the center of the house away from the increasing heat which they did not understand. The father thought, "I know my sons well, I know them exactly, the differences in their characters, their every shade of temperament. I know they will only come out if they think there is some gain, some new toy here." And so he went back to the door and called loudly, "Boys, boys, come out immediately. I have toys for you here beside the door. Bullock chariots, goat chariots, and a chariot as fleet as the wind because it is drawn by a deer. Come quickly or you shall not have them." The boys, not fearing the fire, not fearing the dangers of the flaming roof and walls, but fearing only to lose the toys, came rushing out. They came rushing, scrambling, pushing each other in their eagerness to be first to reach the toys and have first choice. And as the last one left the building, the flaming roof fell in amid a shower of sparks and debris. The boys heeded not the dangers just surmounted, but set up a great clamor. "Father, father, where are the toys which you promised us? Where are the three chariots? We hurried and they are not here. You promised, father." The father, a rich man to whom the loss of his house was no great blow, now that his sons were safe, hurried them off and bought them their toys, the chariots, knowing that his artifice had saved the lives of his sons. The Buddha turned to Sariputra and said, "Now Sariputra, was not that artifice justified? Did not that man by using innocent means, justify the end? Without his knowledge his sons would have been consumed in the flames." Sariputra turned to the Buddha and said, "Yes, O Master, the end well justified the means and brought much good. The Lama Minyadon Up smiled at me as he said, "You were left for 3 days outside the Chakpori. You thought you were barred from entry, yet we were using a test on you, a means which was justified in the end, for you progress well. I too am using a means which will be justified in the end. I am writing this, my true story, the third eye and doctor from Lhasa are absolutely true also, in order that I may later continue with my aura work. So many people have written to ask why I write that I give them the explanation. I write the truth in order that Western people may know that the soul of man is greater than these Sputniks, or fizzling rockets. Eventually man will go to other planets by astral travel as I have done. But Western man will not so go while all he thinks of is self-gain, self-advancement and never mind the rights of the other fellow. I write the truth in order that I may later advance the cause of the human aura. Think of this, it will come. A patient walks into a doctor's consulting room. The doctor does not bother to make any inquiries, he just takes out a special camera and photographs the aura of the patient. Within a minute or so, this non-clairvoyant medical practitioner has in his hand a color photograph of his patient's aura. He studies it, its striations and shades of color, just as a psychiatrist studies the recorded brain waves of a mentally sick person. The general practitioner, having compared the color photograph with standard charts, writes down a course of ultrasonic and color spectrum treatments which will repair the deficiencies of the patient's aura. Cancer? It will be cured. TB tuberculosis, short for tubercle bacillus, that too will be cured. Ridiculous. Well, just a short time ago it was ridiculous to think of sending radio waves across the Atlantic. Ridiculous to think of flying at more than 100 miles an hour. The human body would not stand the strain, they said. Ridiculous to think of going into space. Monkeys have already. This ridiculous idea of mine. I have seen it working. The noises from without penetrated my room, bringing me back to the present. Noises? Shunting trains, a screaming fire engine whizzed by, and loud talking people hasten into the bright lights of a local place of entertainment. Later, I tell myself, when this terrible clamor stops, I will use the crystal and will tell them that I will do as they ask. A growing warm feeling inside tells me that they already know, and are glad. So, here as it is directed, the truth, the Rampa story. Chapter 2, Tibet, at the turn of the century, was beset by many problems. Britain was making a great uproar, shouting to all the world that Tibet was too friendly with Russia, to the detriment of British imperialism. The Tsar of all the Russias was shrieking in the vast halls of his palace in Moscow, complaining vociferously that Tibet was becoming too friendly with Britain. The royal court of China resounded with fevered accusations that Tibet was being too friendly with Britain and with Russia and was most certainly not friendly enough with China. Lhasa swarmed with spies of various nations, poorly disguised as mendicant monks or pilgrims, or missionaries, or anything which seemed to offer a plausible excuse for being in Tibet at all. Sundry gentlemen of assorted races met deviously under the dubious cover of darkness to see how they could profit by the troubled international situation. The great 13th, the 13th Dalai Lama incarnation and a great statesman in his own right, kept his temper and the peace and steered Tibet clear of embroilment. Polite messages of undying friendship, and insincere offers of protection cross the sacred Himalayas from the heads of the leading nations of the world. Into such an atmosphere of trouble and unrest I was born. As Grandmother Rampa so truly said, I was born to trouble and have been in trouble ever since, and hardly any of it of my own making. The seers and soothsayers were loud in their praise of the boy's inborn gifts of clairvoyance and telepathy. An exalted ego, said one. Destined to leave his name in history, said another. A great light to our cause, said a third. And I, at that early age, raised up my voice in hearty protest at being so foolish as to be born once again. Relatives, as soon as I was able to understand their speech, took every opportunity to remind me of the noise I made. They told me with glee that mine was the most raucous, the most unmusical voice that it had been their misfortune to hear. Father was one of the leading men of Tibet. A nobleman of high degree, he had considerable influence in the affairs of our country. Mother, too, through her side of the family, exercised much authority in matters of policy. Now, looking back over the years, I am inclined to think that they were almost as important as mother thought, and that was of no mean order. My early days were spent at our home near the Potala, just across the Kling Chu, or Happy River. Happy because it gave life to Lhasa as it ran chuckling over many brooks, and meandered in rivulet form through the city. Our home was well wooded, well staffed with servants, and my parents lived in princely splendor. I was subjected to much discipline, much hardship. Father had become greatly soured during the Chinese invasion in the first decade of the century, and he appeared to have taken an irrational dislike to me. Mother, like so many society women throughout the world, had no time for children, looking upon them as things to be got rid of as speedily as possible, and then parked on some hired attendant. Brother Palja did not stay with us long. Before his 7th birthday he left for the heavenly fields and peace. I was 4 years of age then, and father's dislike for me seemed to increase from that time. Sister Yasodhara was 6 at the time of the passing of our brother, and we both bemoaned, not the loss of our brother, but the increased discipline which started at his passing. Now my family are all dead, killed by the Chinese communists. My sister was killed for resisting the advances of the invaders. My parents for being landowners. The home from whence I gazed wide-eyed over the beautiful parkland has been made into dormitories for slave workers. In one wing of the house are women workers, and in the right wing are men. All are married, and if husband and wife behave and do their quota of work, they can see each other once a week for half an hour, after which they are medically examined. But in the far-off days of my childhood these things were in the future. Something which was known would happen but which, like death at the end of one's life, did not obtrude too much. The astrologers had indeed foretold these happenings, but we went about our daily life blissfully oblivious of the future. Just before I was 7 years of age, at the age when my brother left this life, there was a huge ceremonial party at which the state astrologers consulted their charts and determined what my future was going to be. Everyone who was anything was there. Many came uninvited by bribing servants to let them in. The crush was so thick that there was hardly room to move in our ample grounds. The priest fumbled and bumbled, as priests will, and put on an impressive show before announcing the outstanding points of my career. In fairness I must state that they were absolutely right in everything unfortunate which they said. Then they told my parents that I must enter Vichakpurai Lamasri to be trained as a medical monk. My gloom was quite intense, because I had a feeling that it would lead to trouble. No one listened to me, though, and I was shortly undergoing the ordeal of sitting outside the Lamasri gate for 3 days and nights just to see if I had the endurance necessary to become a medical monk. That I passed the test was more a tribute to my fear of father than of my physical stamina. Entry to the Vichakpurai was the easiest stage. Our days were long. It was hard indeed to have a day which started at midnight, and which required us to attend services at intervals throughout the night as well as throughout the day. We were taught the ordinary academic stuff, our religious duties, matters of the metaphysical world, and medical lore, for we were to become medical monks. Our Eastern cures were such that Western medical thought still cannot understand them. Yet, Western pharmaceutical firms are trying hard to synthesize the potent ingredients which are in the herbs we used. Then, the age-old Eastern remedy, now artificially produced in a laboratory, will have a high-sounding name and will be hailed as an example of Western achievement. Such is progress. When I was 8 years of age I had an operation which opened my third eye. That special organ of clairvoyance which is moribund in most people because they deny its existence. With this eye-seeing, I was able to distinguish the human aura and so divine the intention of those around me. It was, and is exclamation mark most entertaining to listen to the empty words of those who pretended friendship for self-gain, yet truly had black murder in their hearts. The aura can tell the whole medical history of a person. By determining what is missing from the aura, and replacing the deficiencies by special radiations, people can be cured of illness. Because I had stronger than usual powers of clairvoyance I was very frequently called upon by the inmost one, the great 13th incarnation of the Dalai Lama, to look at the aura of those who visited him in friendship. My beloved guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, a very capable clairvoyant, trained me well. He also taught me the greatest secrets of astral traveling, which now to me is easier than walking. Almost anyone, no matter what they call their religion, believes in the existence of a soul or other body. Actually, there are several bodies or sheaths, but the exact number does not concern us here. We believe, rather, we know that it is possible to lay aside the ordinary physical body, the one that supports the clothes, and travel anywhere, even beyond the earth, in the astral form. Everyone does astral traveling, even the ones who think it is all nonsense. It is as natural as breathing. Most people do it when they are asleep and so, unless they are trained, they know nothing about it. How many people, in the morning, exclaim, "Oh, I had such a wonderful dream last night, I seem to be with so and so. We were very happy together and she said she was writing." Of course it is all very vague now. And then, usually in a very few days a letter does arrive. The explanation is that one of the persons traveled astrally to the other, and because they were not trained, it became a dream. Almost anyone can astral travel. How many authenticated cases there are of dying persons visiting a loved one in a dream in order to say goodbye. Again, it is astral traveling. The dying person, with the bonds of the world loosened, easily visits a friend in passing. The trained person can lie down and relax and then ease off the ties that chain the ego, or companion body, or soul, call it what you will, it is the same thing. Then, when the only connection between is the silver cord, the second body can drift off, like a captive balloon at the end of its line. Wherever you can think of, there you can go, fully conscious, fully alert, when you are trained. The dream state is when a person astral travels without knowing it, and brings back a confused, jumbled impression. Unless one is trained, there are a multitude of impressions constantly being received by the silver cord which confuses the dreamer more and more. In the astral you can go anywhere, even beyond the confines of the earth, for the astral body does not breathe, nor does it eat. All its wants are supplied by the silver cord which, during life, constantly connects it to the physical body. The silver cord is mentioned in the Christian Bible, lest the silver cord be severed, and the golden bowl be shattered. The golden bowl is the halo or nimbus around the head of a spiritually evolved person. Those not spiritually evolved have a halo of a very different color. Artists of old painted a golden halo around the pictures of saints because the artists actually saw the halo, otherwise he would not have painted it. The halo is merely a very small part of the human aura, but is more easily seen because it is usually much brighter. If scientists would investigate astral travel and auras, instead of meddling with fizzling rockets which so often fail to go into orbit, they would have the complete key to space travel. By astral projection they could visit another world and so determine the type of ship needed to make the journey in the physical, for astral travel has one great drawback: one cannot take any material object nor can one return with any material object. One can only bring back knowledge. So, the scientists will need a ship in order to bring back live specimens and photographs with which to convince an incredulous world, for people cannot believe a thing exists unless they can tear it to pieces in order to prove that it might be possible after all. I am particularly reminded of a journey into space which I took. This is absolutely true, and those who are evolved will know it as such. It does not matter about the others, they will learn when they reach a greater stage of spiritual maturity. This is an experience which happened some years ago when I was in Tibet studying at the Chakporai Lamasery. Although it happened many years ago, the memory of it is as fresh in my mind as if it happened but yesterday. My guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, and a fellow Lama, actually a close friend of mine named Jigme, and I, were upon the roof of the Chakporai, on Iron Mountain, in Lhasa, Tibet. It was a cold night indeed, some 40 degrees below zero. As we stood upon the exposed roof, the shrieking wind pressed our robes tightly against our shivering bodies. At the side of us away from the wind our robes streamed out like prayer flags, leaving us chilled to the marrow, threatening to pull us over the precipitous mountainside. As we looked about us, leaning heavily against the wind to maintain our balance, we saw the dim lights of Lhasa City in the distance, while off to our right the lights of the Potala added to the mystical air of the scene. All the windows seemed to be adorned with gleaming butter lamps, which even though protected by the mighty walls, wavered and danced at the bidding of the wind. In the faint starlight the golden roofs of the Potala were reflecting and glinting as if the moon itself had descended and played among the pinnacles and tombs atop the glorious building. But we shivered in the bitter cold, shivered, and wished that we were warm in the incense-laden air of the temple beneath us. We were on the roof for a special purpose, as the Lama Miniadon up enigmatically put it. Now he stood between us, seemingly as firm as the mountain itself, as he pointed upwards at a far distant star, a red-looking world, and said, "My brothers, this is the star Gero, an old, old planet, one of the oldest in this particular system. Now it is approaching the end of its long lifetime." He turned to us with his back to the biting wind, and said, "You have studied much in astral traveling. Now, together, we will travel in the astral to that planet. We will leave our bodies here upon this windswept roof, and we will move up beyond the atmosphere, beyond even time." So saying, he led the way across the roof to where there was some slight shelter afforded by a projecting cupola of the roof. He lay down and bade us to lie beside him. We wrapped our robes tightly around us and each held the hand of the other. Above us was the deep purple vault of the heavens, speckled with faint pinpricks of light, colored light, because all planets have different lights when seen in the clear night air of Tibet. Around us was the shrieking wind, but our training had always been severe, and we thought naught of remaining on that roof. We knew that this was not to be an ordinary journey into the astral, for we did not often leave our bodies thus exposed to inclement weather. When a body is uncomfortable, the ego can travel further and faster and remember in greater detail. Only for small transit journeys does one relax and make the body comfortable. My guide said, "Now let us clasp our hands together, and let us project ourselves together beyond this earth. Keep with me and we will journey far and have unusual experiences this night." We lay back and breathed in the accepted pattern for astral traveling release. I was conscious of the wind screaming through the cords of the prayer flags which fluttered madly above us. Then, all of a sudden, there was a jerk, and I felt no more the biting fingers of the chill wind. I found myself floating as if in a different time, above my body, and all was peaceful. The Lama Miniadon up was already standing erect in his astral form, and then, as I looked down, I saw my friend Jigme also leaving his body. He and I stood and made a link to join us to our guide the Lama Miniadon up. This link, called ectoplasm, is manufactured from the astral body by thought. It is the material from which mediums produce spirit manifestations. The bond completed, we soared upwards, up into the night sky. I, ever inquisitive, looked down. Beneath us, streaming beneath us, were our silver cords, those endless cords which join the physical and the astral bodies during life. We flew on and on, upwards. The earth receded. We could see the corona of the sun peering across the far ridge of the earth in what must have been the Western world into which we had so extensively traveled in the astral. Higher we went and then we could see the outlines of the oceans and continents in the sunlit part of the world. From our height the world now looked like a crescent moon, but with the aurora borealis, or northern lights, flashing across the poles. We moved on and on, faster and faster, until we outstripped the speed of light, for we were disembodied spirits, soaring ever onwards, approaching almost the speed of thought. As I looked ahead of me I saw a planet, huge and menacing and red, straight in front of me. We were falling towards it at a speed impossible to calculate. Although I had had much experience of astral traveling, I felt pangs of alarm. The astral form of the Lama Miniadon up chuckled telepathically and said, "Oh Lobsang, if we were to hit that planet it would not hurt the Morus. We should go straight through it, there would be no bar." At last we found ourselves floating above a red, desolate world, red rocks, red sand in a tideless red sea. As we sank down towards the surface of this world, we saw strange creatures like huge crabs moving lethargically along the water's edge. We stood upon that red rock shore and looked upon the water, tideless, deadly, with red scum upon it, stinking scum.